All right, mechanics time. Now, here I'd like you to think about the mechanics of parenting, and I want to give you just some practical tools, would be the best way to say it. Not all these tools are relevant to your immediate season, but certain ones will be relevant and things that you should put in your toolkit as you're parenting. So what are our goals, number one? Our goals are going to help us make decisions. Our number one goal is to please the Lord as a parent. And if we're talking about outcomes at all, it's that our child would follow Christ. So that's the principle that I need to keep in mind as I parent my children. Number one, I want to honor the Lord in the way that I parent them. The outcome is that Christ would save them by the work of his Spirit. So practically, I'd like to get into like some of the how-tos of this, some biblical priorities. How do I have a place of influence in my child's life? There's going to be two overarching things that I want to suggest to you as part of the how-tos. One is the structure of our homes, how we're orienting ourselves. The next is going to be in the instruction that we give. So structure and instruction, structure and instruction. How do you have a place where you can actually influence your child? Many of you with adult kids at home, you have no authority or you have very little authority over them. They're 21, 22, 23, and your authority over them is mostly like a landlord, if that makes sense. Like, hey, here's what we expect you to do while you live here. So if you're going to stay here, this is what you're going to do. That's your authority. I know it gets awkward in America that the older a child lives with us, there's sometimes like cultural expectations that are going with that. But that's changing with the cost of living. If you haven't noticed, cost of living is going up for homes. So then the 20-somethings, like it's hard for them to move out and buy a house unless you're in the Midwest. You know, like just moving out at 22 and buying a home, like that just doesn't happen anymore. So a lot of kids are staying at home longer. That's not inherently a point of shame, although obviously it could be one if you're not being faithful as a kid. But if you have an adult child living at home and they're saving up because it's expensive to buy a house in Anchorage, then notice like you have a little bit of authority and a lot of influence. If you have a one-year-old, you have a lot of authority and basically no influence. Is that fair to say? I'm all for the parent that thinks they have influence over their two-year-old. I'm all for that. Just please don't fly on the airplane the same time I'm going to fly on it. Because it's always the mom that's like, honey, we don't act like that in the grocery store. And the kid's like, whoa-bam! Honey, we don't hit mom. And I'm like, lady, grab that kid. Get control of the situation. We don't have influence over our young kids. We have influence over our kids as they're getting older. And if you remember the Ted Tripp-ism, he wrote the book Shepherding a Child's Heart, and his goal is that, which I think is a worthy observation, the goal is that as our authority is going down, our influence is going up. So your kids are crossing the puberty line, and there's less imperatives and more influence that you're offering to them. So how do you keep yourself in a position as a parent where you have that relational influence? Let me give you a suggestion, and hopefully this is helpful to you. Are you familiar with the idea of a foxhole? Dig it out, like a battle position that you take. It was used more when infantry was popular, and infantries were used to invade different countries and spaces. We're digging the hole. We're fighting the battle with you. Think of a foxhole for a second. Or think of a lifeguard tower. Lifeguard tower. We're not in the pool with you. We're up observing with you. Overall, what's going to be more effective? To jump in, toot the whistle at your kids when they get out of line, or to be living life next to them and encouraging them along the way? I think you'll find that you'll have more relational influence in a foxhole parenting style as opposed to I only step in when things go wrong style. The lifeguard parenting is necessary at times, but as best as we can, we want to have a relationship with our kid through which we can influence them, as opposed to just telling them when they're wrong. And if you find yourself just telling them when they're wrong, your influence will diminish and your relationship will grow adversarial. And sometimes teenagers, the way they're being approached is what's encouraging them to be adversarial. It's not necessarily that they're just a teenager and rebellious. You okay with that? If you approached any adult like that, they would rebel against what you said. So, of course, an immature teenager is rebelling against what you've said. So think through foxhole parenting. We want to have a relationship with them. Okay, here are some things that I need to assess and biblical priorities that will help protect my family from unnecessary temptations to sinful living. Do I have provocative traits as a parent? Where do I need to get the log out of my own eye? Am I a neglectful parent? Distant, absent, busy. Am I angry and abusive? I'm violent, angry, bitter, resentful, or am I overbearing? You've heard of the idea of helicopter parenting. Helicopter parents, they're struggling with control, and it frustrates kids. It frustrates them because we say you should be acting like an adult, but yet we are treating them like a child. And I'll never forget, we were at a camp out with our church out in Carpinteria, and I'll never forget watching a mom of an 18-year-old male tell her son how to make his plate. Hey, honey, the chips are under there. You can grab the chips. And I was like, lady, this guy's 18. You're telling him how to put tortilla chips on a plate. What do you expect is going to happen? You're going to either raise a baby, is what's going to happen. You have to teach him how to put tortilla chips on his plate. Or he's going to get so frustrated by you that he's going to buck and then exit. So overbearing, do you have overbearing tendencies, a provocative trait? Are you allowing your kids to enter into sinful environments and not protecting them from sinful environments? You're not being discerning about school and family and work. So your priority needs to be that you're helping think through, is this sports team really beneficial for you following Christ? Or are you surrounded by a bunch of thugs? And not everyone has the opportunity to do homeschool or to change to private school. And I know there's different socioeconomic status in this room and even preferences that go with that. But you do recognize that whenever your child is embedded with unbelievers 90% of their day, that that is going to rub off in the way that they're living their life. So are you discerning about the environment that they're embedded in, or are you lacking discernment in that? How do you need to think through the environment of your child? What priority do you need to change there? Are you, as a parent, providing stability and stewardship that blesses your kids? Just think it through. Okay, key definitions. Every family needs to have its own version of this. If you don't have a definition of this, it gets super confusing because your tendency is going to come out, and your tendency may be good or it may be unbiblical. What does obedience mean in your house? What does it mean? You don't have to use my definition of obedience, but you need an agreed-upon definition as a family for what obedience means. Some of you have a Von Trappian understanding of obedience. You guys remember Sound of Music? The heels are alive. Dude toots the whistle. The kids march out. Tunk, 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 tunk. You're more than welcome to try that in your house. Let me know how it goes. Greg@transform.org. I don't think that's realistic. You're going to have very rebellious kids. That's what's going to happen. But you do need to know, when is your child being disobedient? All right, for your teenage children, the definition of obedience is just as important for your three-year-old child. Hey, this is what we expect when we say obedience. It means something like doing it the first time without complaining. Doing it the first time without complaining. Are you being obedient if I say, hey, man, you need to take the trash out, and you're like, cling, 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 trash juice, cling, cling, slam, didn't put the bag back in. You told me to take the trash out. It's like, okay, was that obedience? Nar. That was not obedience. You did not do what I asked you to do without complaining. Find your own way of saying, look, when we say do it, you press pause on whatever you're watching, and you jump up and you go get it. And if you don't, then I'm beginning to interpret this as disobedience. Now, which one of you has the child that says, I didn't hear you? None of you, right? None of you do. I didn't hear what you said, Dad. And you're like, oh, great. Okay, well, if you don't hear me, I'm going to interpret that as you don't prioritize what I'm saying, which will also be interpreted as disobedience. So you have to learn how to listen more attentively in the future. But we're not going to play these wiggle out of it games. When we've said it, we expect that you do it without complaining and making a fuss. Okay, here's my 2 cents. For those of you that got kids under 5, if you can help teach your kids under 5 this right now, it will bless you the rest of your life. They don't magically become a monster at 12 years old. Is that fair to say? What happens is that unchecked discipline gets to 12 and they're becoming a hormonal adult. And now we're thinking like, man, I have this rebellious junior hire. It's like, well, no, you had a rebellious 9-year-old and you had a rebellious 6-year-old. And now they're at this breaking point at 12, 13, 14. But that's been there all along. Help your children have a godly respect of authority as a young child, and it blesses you the rest of your life. Obedience, doing it the first time without complaining. All right, you get one appeal. You have to appeal in a gracious way. And then you're going to obey, you're going to accept, you're going to follow through on whatever decision that mom and I have made. So you and I have been in an environment where a child, maybe our child, maybe someone else's child, continues to ask and ask and ask and ask. And then finally the parent's like, okay, just go. Just like, go do it. I know we all make that decision unintentionally, but by and large, we're going to give you and we're going to teach you that you get one appeal, and whatever my answer is to your appeal is going to be the final answer. So one gracious, respectful appeal, and that's it. We're not going to play the game of you keep asking, so you learn that if you bother me enough, I'm just going to give in to it. And that's true for any age. That's true for your young kids. That's true for your teenage kids. One appeal, that's it. One warning, that's it. One warning. Don't be the parents that have the 2-year-old that you're like, one thousand and a quarter. I'll do it. Don't make me do it. 1/1,003/4. And the kid's like, you ain't doing it, lady. They're like over there smoking a cigarette. It ain't happening. What has your child learned at that point? It's like, you don't mean business until you get to whatever that magical number is. That's what your child has learned. So you're going to say something like, hey, this is your warning. This is your one warning. And after this, I'm going to interpret it as disobedience. Guess whose heart rate did not go up? Right? Like, guess who's not angry and yelling at everybody in the house? We're not getting irate. We're not getting crazy. We're just saying, hey, look, I've warned you now. You've clearly heard that I've warned you. And if you continue to do this, I'm just going to interpret it as disobedience. That's how this is going to work. If you don't have these definitions, it's chaotic in your home, just to be candid. You don't have to have my definition, but you do need to have a definition in parenting. So if you're wondering about some of the rebelliousness in your kids or inattentive, I would say get back to the fundamentals for a second and make sure that you have this and it's clear so that you and your spouse are doing the same thing. So what responsibilities do I have as a parent? Faithfulness in following through to honor the Lord by providing a structured environment and godly instruction. Okay, let me go to faithfulness for structured environment and godly instruction. Okay, couple of things here to think through. God has given us the ability to structure our homes and to set them up in a certain way to be a benefit for our kids. God has given you the ability to do that. And that is young kids, that's teenage kids, and that's even your 20-something-year-old adult child living at home. You can control the structure of your home. You are also called to instruct in a godly and biblical way. That's part of your Ephesians 6:4 requirements. The act of providing guidance for responsible living, upbringing, and training. So primarily, how are we going about the task of parenting? I want you to think structure and instruction primarily. These are the primary tasks that we have. What goes into our structure? The things that we're actually trying to accomplish. Now, I don't want you to look at this list and say, like, okay, Gifford's saying everything has to be present all the time. But I do want you to look at this list and see, like, this is a general help for understanding the way that my home should operate. Okay, examples of this. Number one, biblical roles of mom and dad. That we as a couple are doing our best to live out what it looks like to be a husband and a wife before our kids. And as you do that well, you're going to instruct. We want dad to be a godly, present leader in the house. And we want mom to be a godly, present supporter of dad and also a co-laborer in the house. So biblical roles are an important part of providing structure for your kids. A schedule is an important part of structure for your kids. I'm hoping that you follow some type of schedule in even your parenting strategy. You're determining things like bedtimes, what time you're allowed to wake up, what time you're getting off devices, what time you need to be home. This is your structure for your schedule. My two cents is that you're syncing up with your spouse about preferences on your schedule. Generally speaking, in our house, we follow like what grade are you in high school, and that's what time you go to bed. 11th grade? All right, 11 p.m. is generally when we want you to be in bed. For the younger kids, it was always like 7:30, 8 o'clock whenever they went to bed. And why is that? It's like, because mom and I are exhausted. Get out of our face right now. You know, I mean, we love you. Good night. Is it 7:30 yet? Watch chaotic homes have no structure in their schedule, right? It's like the four-year-old's up at midnight, sleeping until 10 a.m., and it's like, hey, you got to reel that in and just provide a general level of bedtime, nap time, eating, structure, calendaring. Okay, that's the type of structure that you provide. So roles, number one. Schedule, number two. Consistent consequences, number three. If you're not developing consequences as a parent, you will allow things to escalate to a point of being more and more chaotic. This is your fault, not your child's fault. Develop a plan of parenting where you articulate your expectations and you also articulate the blessings of obedience and the consequences of disobedience. You maybe have heard me talk about it on Transformed. You're going to have an example in the digital note packet. You can email me and I would be happy to provide it for you. But essentially what you're going to do is say, look, when you do what I'm expecting you to do, there are blessings. And when you don't do it, there are consequences. And in the structure of our home, we're not going to get loud with you and we're not going to get crazy. We're just going to follow through on the consequences of disobedience. Or we're just going to give you the blessings. I have learned that some parents control their kids by getting loud. They just get loud so the kid shuts down. But we're not going to yell at our kids. We're not provoking them to anger. That's the direct call of Ephesians 6:4. We're not teaching them by just getting loud and instructing them. So what you have to notice is that if you don't have consistent consequences, that's on you. Your kids are learning they can go to mom and get a different consequence from going to dad. So what is the consequence? Articulate that as a couple and then hold the line together that this is not dad's idea or mom's idea. This is our idea that we have consistent consequences. Okay, that's a structure that you provide. You know, this may seem weird, but noise level in a home is a structure that you provide, that you're creating an environment at home where you're not yelling, we're not screaming at each other as brothers and sisters. The siblings aren't allowed to scream and yell. Even think of like music, TV. We're doing our best to create an environment at home that's conducive towards godliness and us being faithful. So noise level, home life, stable home life, and location. I have added and location because we do control decisions that would make us move. For instance, there are times where you will be approached for a job, but that job requires you to move. And you're going to say, look, this is my kid's junior year. This is my kid's senior year. This doesn't seem like the best time to take a job that's going to make us transplant everybody. Okay, your kid's under five. They're not even going to know you move. Like, they're just going to show up in the new place, make friends. It's awesome. But I always thought, like, part of the disruption that we create is when we're not being consistent in our jobs, so we have no choice but to bounce around. And there are some individuals that have prioritized their job over their family. And that stinks to say. So how are you helping parent? You're making decisions about your home life and location that are just promoting stability. That's all we're saying. It's not rocket science, but please don't move in the senior year for your child as best as you can. Like, I know that there's extenuating circumstances. I know that there's military. I know that there's things that I just can't control it all the time. But by and large, we're being thoughtful about the toll that that has on our kids. Okay, so you got noise level, stable home life, location, consistent and gentle correction, that we do use the rod, and I would be glad to talk about that in the Q&A. But we are willing to use the rod, but we're always going to do in a self-controlled and gentle way. And then lastly, financial provisions that are content in the Lord's provisions. Having food and clothing, with these we will be content. Think of your provisions as a way of caring for your kids. I am of the opinion, and you guys can karate chop me for this, I am of the opinion that if you have a lot of money, you have to be very careful with your kids. Some of those that have the most money, they don't teach their kids how to be content and to work hard. And, you know, this is surprising. You would think at Masters, like, the best kids were the full-time students. It's not like that. The best students are often the ones that are working part-time or working two part-time jobs and going to school full-time. And sometimes the most fragile students are the ones where their parents are paying for everything. So before we're like, man, I want to give my child everything, that is not always helpful to them. And I'm experiencing it in the classroom. So think, we want to provide for our kids that teaches them responsibility, but not in a way that enables them to be unfaithful. So if God's given you a lot of money, just be careful that you're not using it to immobilize your kids instead of mobilizing it towards faithfulness. So financial provisions that encourage them to be content and to work hard. So if you're thinking of this list, I'd like you to think like, okay, in my home, do these things generally happen? Consistent consequences. We have schedules that are somewhat synced up. We have a somewhat stable home life. We're not always bouncing around, moving different places. It's not always a new job. Our financial provisions are enough, or maybe we have plenty, but we're living on our own, or we're living within our means and honoring the Lord in that. Just think like, does your home look something like this? Because if not, this is something that you can fix as a parent. Is there an area on this where you're like, hey, I do need to tinker with that as a parent, or we do need to as parents? Our consequences are all over the place. We haven't prioritized a stable home life. If you walked into our home, it'd be like a war zone went off. It's just unclean and loud everywhere. Okay, lock it in. Lock it in. These are the things that you can control. Structure. You can control structure. The last thing that I want to share is that you can control instruction. So let's think through instruction just for a moment, and I'd like you to grab your Bible and go with me to Deuteronomy chapter 6. Okay, remember foxhole parenting, that we're with you, we're supporting you, we're going to walk alongside of you. We're not lifeguards who are just going to interact with you whenever something's going wrong. The way that Moses instructs the children of Israel to teach their children is very helpful. And you'll notice that most of it, most if not all of it here in Deuteronomy 6, is informal instruction. These are the words. This is Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 6. These words that I command you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, and when you lie down. When you rise, you shall bind them as a sign on your hand and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. Notice how instruction is unfolding here. Teach them to your kids. going into the promised land. What are you going to remind your children of in the promised land? All that Moses has written. The number one command that Jesus will quote, Matthew 22, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might. What are you teaching your kids? How to love the Lord. How are you doing it? Talk of them when you sit in your house. What? Is there a lecture hall for that? Like, is there a scheduled event? Did Dad pass out an outline and there's a PowerPoint? Just think, like, when we're in the house, we have this informal. We're sitting and we're chatting. When you walk by the way, we're commuting with our kids. Some of you are in the transit phase where you feel like an Uber driver and a parent. It's like you're commuting with your kids and you're getting them to their next thing and you're talking about the day and you're instructing them. When you lie down, this is the bedtime stories. Some of you get in the habit of getting to read and speak with your kids or pray with them before they're going to bed. When are you actually doing the work? It's a lifestyle of communication. I want you to think, like, I'm not setting up an instructional period in my house to establish this formal lecture for my kids, that throughout the majority of our day, I'm inserting an opportunity to talk about God, His Word, what God is doing, how was school, how do you deal with hurt, how do you deal with disappointment and frustration. That didn't take a 30-minute lecture, that was a 5-minute car ride home. Boom. Most of what you'll see when you think of instruction in the scripture, most of what you'll see is informal. Isn't that a fascinating thought to consider? Like, it's informal. My kids respond best to the informal stuff, not to the formal stuff. I would love that, like, cloven tongues of fire started raining from on high. I'm like, hey, kids, you know what time it is. And they're like, really, Dad? You're going to teach us the word? Oh, you know I am. It ain't like that. It's usually like 11 o'clock at night, and then my teenager bumbles into the room, and he's like, hey, Dad. And I'm like, oh, no. We're doing it right now, aren't we? It's about to happen. It's the late-night conversations with your junior high and high schooler. You know, they're staying up late, and you're like, man, I can't do this. That's the informal conversation that's most meaningful. They come and sit on the bed, you turn the light back on, and you have the conversation with them. For your 10 and under kids, just think like it's in the moment. Like, I'm having that instructional opportunity. You were offended, you were hurt, you were betrayed, you're disappointed, you're embarrassed. We are going to spend some time asking them informally and then instructing to them. You know, I've given you a couple of questions to think through. What do you think God would want you to do? Do you have your own way of asking that for your kids? What do you think God would want you to do? Or what does the Bible say you should do? Maybe, like, some of you, you're not super clear on what to say yourself. Like, I want to help parent them, and I need to grow in that. You do have to grow in a biblical acumen and the ability to use God's word. But notice, like, in that moment where your child fails or is hurt or is betrayed, you're going to say, hey, what's God doing right now? What does God want you to do? That's me providing informal instruction. And then there's going to be a question of what does the Bible say, or how does God want us to respond as he mentions in his word? You know, I would love for that to be like this revelatory moment, but sometimes one of my kids will just say, I don't know. I don't know. And you're just going to say, well, can I share with you what the Bible says about this? Like, when you're sinned against, here's what the scripture says about being sinned against. Let's go to Romans 12 and talk about overcoming evil with good. Oh, okay. When you're hurt, where can we go when we're hurt? How does Christ respond in 1 Peter 4:19 when he's betrayed? He doesn't revile in return. He entrusts his soul to a faithful creator while doing good. So I'm going to ask my kids in an informal way and do my best to instruct and guide them in that way. You know, my two cents is that formal instruction in the home is your family worship or your family devotions whenever you guys do that. If you don't do family devotions, can I just give you a big picture consideration? This is one of the best ways to bring your family together to provide a proactive instead of a reactionary instruction. Some of us, we're the lifeguard, and we only jump in. It's like, okay, obey mom and dad, because you just got in trouble. So write that out. instead of saying, I want to be reactionary, I'm going to be proactive and say, you know what? I want to disciple my kids in their faith. I want to disciple them in how to study the Bible. I want to disciple them in doctrine and the attributes of God. That's your formal time of instruction. Find a time throughout your week where you're getting everybody together and you're doing your family discipleship, family worship. Okay, dads, you know I've been coming at you at a couple of times throughout today. Who should initiate family discipleship? It's us. It's us. Okay, so if you're not in your devotions, that's going to be weird to lead your family in devotions, right? It's like, oh, I think this is what I'm supposed to say. But if you're vibrant in your walk with Christ, then your devotional time overflows into family worship with your family. So find at least two times a week where you get everybody together and you say, hey, let's do some time in the Word. How long is that going to last? It's totally dependent on how old your kids are. Is that fair? Like, if you got young kids, what's that, like 3 minutes? It's like Dory, you know, you're like, over here, back over here, guys, come on. Come on, focus, 2 more minutes. This is going to be great, I promise. And I've had guys tell me and write into Transform that over time, their kids start to lead aspects of family discipleship. Or one's musical, they grab their guitar. One's reading from the devotional. Great. There is no magical number, but when is it that you're actually going to have a proactive time of instruction with your family? Call it what you want, family discipleship, family worship. How should you do it? Twice a week, you're going to find a time where you can carve out 5 to 20, 30 minutes and spend that time in formal instruction. So God hasn't called you to control the outcome of that, but God has called you to actually follow through on instruction. So what are the big picture ideas on how we go about parenting? Okay, I can create structure in my home. I can do that. If I have an adult child at home, I'm still creating a structure. And if they're the oldest and I have youngers at home, they have to live according to our structure while they're here. You're not going to create chaos and be in the house. So for the adult child living at home, it's one style. And for our two-year-old, it's another style, but we're all creating structure. Second, it's instruction. And primarily, it's informal and some formal instruction for our kids. That as we have opportunity, we're teaching them the Word, primarily by the way, as we sit, as we lie down, and we're doing our best to funnel in the truths of Scripture as God provides opportunities. But in the end, the Lord has to bring the increase. In the end, that's it. 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 7, you are a farmer. A free farmer, you can just be faithful. And you're not called to control the outcome, you're called to be faithful to the process of parenting. So be free in understanding that once you've done that, then you have done all that God has expected you to do as a parent. God has to bring the increase in your kid's life. Okay, pause. You guys survived. Yeah, give yourself a round of applause. Come on, we got it. Mentally, you're there. Let's do some Q&A, if you're open to it. It is almost 2 o'clock, and we got about 15 minutes left, where if you're okay with it, we'll use some of our final time for Q&A, and you can go back to marriage role stuff that we discussed earlier, or we can focus on parenting stuff. And if I don't know, you know, or I haven't experienced it or haven't seen it, I'll just be honest with you. Haven't seen it, don't know. Okay, so you tell me what questions you have, and then I have a couple that I've prepared as well. We got microphones that will come around to you. So if you don't mind raising your hand, then one of the guys in the back will bring a mic around. Okay, question over here to the right.
Hi. Hello.
Hey, yeah, we can hear you.
We're a homeschooling family. This is my husband, David. And I'm just curious from your perspective, being a man, my oldest is 11, a boy, homeschooling. Okay. Do you feel like there's a time where homeschooling is no longer appropriate for males to be home with their moms? Basically, yep. That's my question.
Yep. I will answer this with a couple of biblical principles and then personal experience. So my personal experience isn't authoritative, jettison it. I do think that biblically we as parents have the responsibility to oversee the education, but it doesn't always mean that we're the one to do it, in all fairness. The child helps dictate that a lot. Time and capacity of mom. Some women are like passionate educators, and others do it because there's no great public school in the area, in all fairness. So if you love Latin or you don't love Latin, like that's going to help shape how much you enjoy the process. So you do have an obligation to be part of the education, but you don't have an obligation to do it. And sometimes I'll get heat from my homeschool buddies. We've homeschooled our kids off and on. My middle son is in homeschool this year, so we're all for it. But I don't think you have an obligation to do it. It's often a convenience. It's a help. It's a privilege for some. Some parents both have to work. So just know it's not a duty. It's an opportunity. All right. Do you ever get to a point where it feels like it would be best to not do it? I think so. And here are a couple of ways you know that's coming true. I've told Amber, my wife, I've said, baby, I need you to be my wife first and then the educator of our kids. Because you know, it's a lot of work to homeschool your kids. And if you're totally fried and there's nothing left in the tank for your marriage, then that is a reality where we have to say, we just got to be honest about our capacities and what we're able to do here. I won't mention which one, but some of my kids are super compliant, and others, you have to remind them to breathe. I'm going to take a breath. Okay, now do that again. And do that again. And it's this is hard. I can't, and it creates more conflict between mom and child. So in counseling and in my own personal life, there have been times where I've said, look, it seems like for a season, it would be best to send them to school so you can get a breather as mom and so that someone else can remind them to breathe at school. And you can just step in and support them, but not have so much conflict, tension, frustration in the home. Because your principal, your teacher, your mom, and many times I think the better part of wisdom is to say, look, this is too stressful. We're going to send you to someone else. And oftentimes our kids will be more compliant with other people simply out of fear of man, simply because they don't want to get in trouble in front of other people and be embarrassed. So in wisdom, I do think that it makes sense for an 11-year-old boy to say, look, this isn't going well. It's really frustrating for everybody. It's super hard. We're going to try this year a private school, or we're going to try public school, and we're going to see how that goes. Great. So then the better part of wisdom is to say, yes, I think you should go to school. But that may be 7th grade or 6th grade for an 11-year-old, and then we're just going to take it from there. Is it biblical law? Should you just force yourself through it? You can, but I think the stress that it causes on you and your marriage are real considerations as part of that. That doesn't even speak to, am I the most gifted in this area? Am I the best educator? Do I know the most about this discipline? So my two cents is that you have to oversee the process. That's the biblical mandate. And then you're trying to tailor it to your 11-year-old in a way that's helpful. And maybe it would be more helpful for them to go to school at this season and just see how that goes. Does that answer everything? We make that decision yearly on a year-by-year basis with our kids for each kid. Okay, another question. Yes, ma'am.
I have a question about having the consistent consequences. That's something that I feel like my husband and I have really struggled with. We have a 3-year-old girl and a 5-year-old boy.
Okay.
And I feel like our consequences are not consistent because we're desperately trying to figure out which ones actually work. Because it's sometimes, sometimes it'll be I would argue potentially a bribe. It'll be a positive incentive. If you clean your room, then you can watch, 15 minutes of Bluey or something like that. But then sometimes that works, but other days, the positive incentives, maybe they don't want to watch Bluey, maybe they're not feeling Bluey that day. And so then it'll turn into a negative, I would argue a threat. If you don't do this, then, I'm going to throw this out or,
Bluey dies.
Yeah, Bluey, right? Exactly.
Bingo, no.
Exactly. And it's my husband and I are just desperate to see what they actually respond to. And so it feels like the consequences change on like a daily basis. And I was just kind of wondering if you had any tips for getting that consistency and then what you found has worked with your kids, like for the more positive incentives versus like the negative consequence / punishment. Thanks.
Yeah. So here is the way I would frame it. And if you have a note sheet, there's three categories. One is expectation. What do you expect? You clearly articulate that, you and your husband. And let's be even more precise. What do you expect of a 5-year-old and what do you expect of a 3-year-old? And that's different from what you expect of a 15-year-old and a 13-year-old. So what do you expect? What are the blessings for them doing that? So when they do it, what happens? And there's a whole like theology and strategy that goes into you obey, you keep God's word, it goes well with you, and you live long in the land. That's Ephesians 6, 1 through 3. There should be blessings that correspond to obedience. And at 5, you know, like the blessing is Bluey or ice cream or, you know, like whatever other toy is circulating at that point. It's like, yeah, that is a blessing. And what is the consequence? So consequence has really two categories. One is for disobedience. And at 5, there are 5 and 3, both, you know, they can be disobedient. And you know when they're being disobedient. So you're having to articulate what is the consequence of disobedience. There's also one more that I think is important. What's the consequence of childishness as opposed to disobedience? So 5-year-old, it's like you see them with a full glass of milk. You're like, this ain't going well. You know, like they're like walking around and you're like, no, I just shampooed the carpet. Okay, the consequence is you go get a towel and you help us clean the mess up. I'm not spanking you for that. But when you're disobedient, that may actually warrant spanking and discipline with the rod. So create your categories, expectation, blessing, consequence. And then in consequence, have childishness and disobedience. Then develop consequences that correspond to 3 and 5. What would be effective? I'm really okay with saying this, and I don't mean it in like a violent way, but I think spankings are helpful at younger ages. Because you can't reason well with a 3-year-old. So you're determining what a spanking looks like. There's principles that are given for that. One SWAT at a designated location with a designated item, a belt, a paddle, something like that. We're going to pray together, and that's going to be the end of it. So over time, what does the 3-year-old know? Well, mom told me to go clean. I didn't. And now I'm facing a consequence of disobedience. Or what does the 5-year-old know? So when you structure your consequences that way, it's easy for you and your husband. We're just going to go and follow through on what the consequence was. Be careful with evaluating the effectiveness of the consequence because it's not yours to control. You're just called to follow through on it. And I know you have to be sensitive, and there are parents that have said, you know, hey, Greg, we have kids with autistic-like tendencies, and so they don't do well with this, they do well with this. It's like, yeah, totally. You adapt it, but remember, it's not your call to control the outcome, it's your call to be faithful to the consequence itself. So if you're not faithful to it, it's never going to seem like it's working because you're not being consistent in it. Is that okay? Good. Other questions? Okay, I think we're going to do one over here. Yes, sir.
You mentioned earlier that yelling is evidence of poor parenting or something like that. But yeah. Dialing back from that, let's say having a stern or firm voice or stern or firm warnings, is that ever appropriate? And at what point does that become inappropriate?
I think think of biblical principles of edifying speech, communication that builds up, doesn't tear down. That's what's framing our don't yell conversation. Then you have provoking your children to anger. That's framing it on this side. Stern warnings are we are under control, but we are telling you, usually with a raised eyebrow, honey, if you do that again, here's what's going to happen. My decibels didn't go up, but you know, like I just gave you the raised eyebrow. Daddy, don't play. This is like Dwayne the Rock Johnson. when this guy goes up, things go down, you know. I think you can have your dad voice of saying, hey, guys, I'm serious. I've asked you to do this, and you're not doing it. So it's your call, and that's your stern warning. You didn't scream. You didn't yell. You didn't get crazy. The madder I get, the more I sound like the Batman, Christian Bale Batman, where I start to talk like this because I'm like trying to control myself, you know? And so they give me a hard time in my house because they're like, oh, there's the voice. You know, Dad's mad. I'm not mad. Do what you're told. So find your gracious way of, we're even keel, but Dad ain't playing. Like, Dad's not playing right now. You guys need to make sure that you're listening up. Was there a follow-up to that?
No, thank you.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, I think there's a mic coming your way. Yes, sir.
Yeah, hi, Greg. Thanks. Earlier you mentioned one spot, belt or paddle, specific location. I was thinking on the body, but maybe you were thinking in the house, or I'm not sure what you meant by location.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That is a good clarifying point. Okay, so in all seriousness, some of this we learned through parenting and through counseling. There was a point, and so in our household, when you're young, under 5, we do have a rule that if you yell, like, we will pop you on the mouth, like, then and there. Like, so if you come up and you're like, Dad, no, bam, like, right on the mouth. That's it. That's all it is, and it is hand to mouth. Not like the disease, but it is, that's foot and mouth. Never mind. So we do have that principle, but by and large, we have a predetermined location that we go to follow through with the rod. And that is 5 and up. Generally speaking, we're going to take you to your bedroom or the bathroom, and we're going to spank you and administer the rod there in private. We also are going to find a paddle, a belt, something that is not ours, like that is not attached to us. And what that helps do is just provide a clear place, tempers can cool. We're going to go to that one location, and we're going to administer discipline in private. Once things de-escalate, we're going to pray with you and leave. So I guess, is it location on the body or location as it's both? Because I do think you should only administer discipline to the rear end or as close to it as you can get, and that you're finding a predetermined location for that. So where is that in your house? You know, is it the room? Is it the bathroom? Is it mom and dad's room? Where is that? Mm-hmm. And as a dad, there have been times where I've had to collect myself and then meet my kids in that designated location. Catch my breath, breathe, pray for forgiveness, and then go there. Okay, good. Other questions? We have a few more minutes left, I think. Yes, sir.
Just thinking through the reality of, you know, real life, and, you know, we're still being sanctified daily, and we're sinners, you know, and in terms of consistent and gentle correction, occasionally anger creeps in, and there's potentially a sin that's committed against the child in terms of just, you know, getting into an overbearing mode. Could you speak to the restoration process, adult to child, that would be sincere and, you know, biblical, but there's always the concern that you're being hypocritical or you're giving away your authority. Mm-hmm. I think that's a real thing with, you know, just day-to-day life.
It's a total real thing, and I mean, I think if any of us were like, man, I perfectly administer discipline and a spirit of patience and Christ-likeness, it's like, you're lying, man. It ain't like that. Because it's hard not to take personal the disobedience of your kid. And for some reason, it's like you are affronting me and my ancestors by acting this way. So what do we do when we sin against a brother or sister or a potential brother or sister if they're not believers? I think we go to them in private. And we confess our sin to them. If it was committed in private, I should confess that in private. And I ask for their forgiveness. And I would love like that rainbows shot from the ground and they loved me and hugged me every time that happened. But sometimes it's like, you know, like whatever, you know, like you, whatever, you know, and they're frustrated by me still. Just like anyone else, we can't control their response, but we do have an obligation to go and to seek their forgiveness. I would add one more to that. If I have sinned against them in front of a group, I need to confess that in front of the group. And maybe the group is our family, or maybe the group was your friend. And I noticed with one of our kids that we weren't trying to be hurtful to him, but we would joke with him and on him in front of friends. And he pulled us aside one day and he said, "Hey, I don't actually appreciate the way that you guys joke on me in front of my friends." And I was like, "Oh, well, oh, my bad. Like, that's totally my bad. I wasn't trying to embarrass you." So I now have an obligation to go in front of the friend group and make sure that I apologize and seek his forgiveness and their forgiveness. So I can't control if my kids appreciate that or not, but I can control that I do that and that I'm biblical in seeking their forgiveness. So as a parent, I think we just have to find our like our way of saying, look, whether you want this or not, we're going to go and seek your forgiveness on things when we have sinned against you. And if it wasn't a sin, but it was a bad idea, I'm still going to apologize, because I would differentiate between sin and forgiveness and apologizing and saying sorry for doing that. I'm going to say sorry for things that I should have done better. And most of the time, if you're sincere, I do think it's received well over time. And you demonstrate change, it's received well. It doesn't mean that our kids are now going to face zero consequences, but it does mean the way that I handled that was wrong and that I should grow in wisdom or that I should repent in that way. So find something like that. We have to find some way of going. And I think Paul Tripp said it well, because he said something to the effect of, this is a demonstration of the gospel where you repent and you admit your own fault and need for mercy. So you're not haughty, you yourself are in need of grace as well. It's good. Okay, other questions? Yes, ma'am.
Hi. So going down to, from my experience so far, only the younger child level, my kids are all five and under, say you've asked them to do something, like clean up their room, and they haven't, and you've given that consequence. They've been disobedient, and you've spanked them. And they remain in that state of disobedience and still want nothing to do with what you've asked them to do. At what point is there, because there's pride and, you know, you kind of want to win over your child and make them do what you've asked them to do. But what is the next step?
Yeah, good. There's the strong-willed child. And I think you just have to be candid. Some kids are super strong-willed. Other kids, you like look at them and you're like, mom's disappointed. And they're like, oh, please, I'll do anything to restore back. I'll clean everywhere. And you're like, that's what I thought. Punk. So think of your strong-willed kid. I think what you need to do is develop tiers of consequences for your strong-willed child. Okay, spanking didn't work. Well, then we're moving to a predetermined second tier. And at five, it's like, okay, maybe it's spankings. And then it's isolation, some timeout format. Maybe it's spanking isolation, you're losing privileges, screen time's going away. So if you react out of anger or frustration, then you like make it up on the spot. It's like, well, I'm spanking you and you're living under the stairs. Like Harry Potter. Okay, well, that doesn't help. You know, they can't even follow through on that. So develop your tiers, follow through on the increasing consequences while still holding the expectation that you will obey and go back and do what I asked you to do. So you're still going to clean the room. So it's your call. It's your call. How painful do you want this to be? So you can correct it now, or we can go to the second tier. You can correct it there, or we go to the third tier. But either way, you're going to go back and do what I asked you to do. What you'll notice is if you don't expect them to follow through, that they'll learn they can buck you hard enough that you'll just give up. And you have to teach them before 12 that that just ain't going to happen. So predetermine, work with your husband, and work with someone that can speak into and say, here are our tiers, and we're going to move to the second tier and the third tier for our strong-willed child. Mm-hmm. Good. Okay, I think, how many? One more? Last one.
Do you think the way that we listen to each other in our marriage is a model to our kids for the listening one time and you expect obedience? I know that it's the marriage relationship is different, but your kids see how you listen to each other in your marriage. Do you think that is a model that sets them up well to obey you the first time that you tell them?
When I ask Amber to obey me, she says no. So it ain't working, okay? I'm just kidding. I stopped asking a long, long time ago. I definitely think mom and dad set the tone for the house and the way they respect and interact with each other. So if mom is like, your dad is such, like, come on, kids, let's go. Your dad thinks he knows everything. Then you cultivate that distrust and that disrespect. The communication style of parents is caught by kids. Like, that is often the way that we communicate by what our parents did. But to your point, it's learning how to interact with each other and yielding. I do think you're both yielding to each other. It's not just a wife thing to a husband. You're both yielding, and you're demonstrating that. But you're also communicating a spirit of submissiveness and not rebelliousness, and you set that tone. So it shouldn't be surprised that many rebellious kids have rebellious parents, and they're exemplifying that in ways they didn't always intend to do. So to your point, yeah, do I think listening, but what is listening doing? We're yielding to each other. And not in a way that we're compromising and getting taken advantage of, but as parents, we're yielding and understanding and we're setting a tone of, yes, this is important to you, so this is what I'm going to do. You care about this and I want to honor you in that. So our kids see that and they represent it to a certain degree. Not perfectly, but if we're exacerbating or we're cultivating the flame of rebelliousness, then we shouldn't be surprised if our kids then turn that on us and they become rebellious toward us. So yeah, 100%. I totally think that they're connected and that your demeanor as a couple sets the stage for the way that your kids will respond to you.